Chapter 2. Seattle, Washington. The aero-slim kayak flew across the sapphire surface of Puget Sound as if it had been shot from a bow. The broad-shouldered man in the snug cockpit seemed at one with the wooden craft. He dipped his paddles in the water with an easy, fluid motion, concentrating the power of his brawny arms into precise strokes that kept the kayak moving at a steady speed. Sweat glistened on the kayaker's rugged, sun-burnished features. His piercing light blue eyes, the color of coral underwater, took in the broad expanse of the sound, the fog-shrouded San Juan Islands, and, in the distance, the snow-capped Olympic Mountains. Kurt Austin gulped the salty air into his lungs and spread his lips in a wide grin. It felt good to be home. Austin's duties as the director of the Special Assignments Team for the National Underwater and Marine Agency constantly took him to far-flung parts of the world. But he had acquired his taste for the sea on the waters around Seattle, where he was born. Puget Sound was as familiar to him as an old flame. He had sailed boats on the Sound almost from the day he could walk and had raced boats since he was 10. His big love was racing boats. He owned 4 of them. An 8-ton catamaran, capable of speeds of more than 100 miles an hour, a smaller outboard hydroplane, a 20-foot sailboat, and a scull that he liked to row early in the morning on the Potomac. The latest addition to his fleet was the custom-made Guillemot kayak. He had bought it on an earlier trip to Seattle. He liked its natural wood construction and the graceful design of the thin hull, which was based on an Aleut craft. Like all his boats, it was fast as well as beautiful. Austin was so intent absorbing the familiar sights and smells that he almost forgot that he was not alone. He glanced over his shoulder. A flotilla of 50 kayaks trailed a few hundred feet behind his ribbon-like wake. The heavy, fiberglass, double-cockpit kayaks each carried one parent and one child. They were safe and stable, and no match for Austin's racehorse. He removed a turquoise Numa baseball cap, revealing a jungle of prematurely gray, almost platinum hair, and waved it high above his head to urge them on. Austin had not hesitated when his father, the wealthy owner of an international marine salvage company based in Seattle, had asked him to lead the annual benefit kayak race he sponsored to raise money for charity. Austin had worked 6 years for Austin Marine Salvage before being lured into a little-known branch of the CIA that specialized in underwater intelligence gathering. After the Cold War ended, the CIA closed down the investigative branch, and Austin was hired by James Sandecker, who headed NUMA before becoming Vice President of the United States. Austin dipped his paddles in the water and steered the kayak toward 2 boats anchored about 100 feet apart, less than a quarter of a mile ahead. The boats carried race officials and press people. Stretched between the boats was a huge red and white plastic banner with the word "Finish" written on it. Rafted together on the other side of the Finish banner was a barge and chartered ferry boat. At the end of the race, the kayaks would be pulled up on the barge and the participants would be treated to lunch aboard the ferry. Austin's father was watching the race in a 48-foot white-hulled powerboat named White Lightning. Digging his paddle in, Austin was preparing for a sprint to the finish when he noticed a flicker of movement out of the corner of his eye. He turned to his right and saw a tall, curved fin cutting through the water in his direction. As he watched, at least 20 more fins popped up behind the first one. Puget Sound was home to several pods of orcas who fed on salmon. They had become local mascots and a big boom to the economy, attracting tourists from all over the world who flocked to Seattle to come out on whale watch boats or take part in kayak adventures. The killer whales would come right up to the kayaks and often put on a show, breaching partially or jumping clear out of the water. Typically, the orcas would glide harmlessly past, often within a few feet of a kayak without disturbing it. When the first fin was about 50 feet away, the orca stood on its tail. Nearly half its 25-foot length was out of the water. Austin stopped paddling to watch. He had seen the maneuver performed before, but it was still an awesome sight. The whale inspecting him was a big bull, probably the leader of the pack, and must have weighed at least 7 tons. Moisture glistened on its sleek, black-and-white body. The whale splashed back into the water, and the fin again moved rapidly in his direction. He expected from experience that at the last second the orca would duck under the kayak. But when it was only a few feet away, the whale again reared up and opened its mouth. The rows of razor-sharp teeth set in the pink mouth were close enough to touch. Austin stared in disbelief. It was as if a beloved circus clown had morphed into a monster. The jaws began to close. Austin jammed the wooden paddle into the creature's maw. There was a loud snap as the teeth closed on the paddle. The whale's massive body came down on the front part of the 35-pound kayak and smashed it to splinters. Austin went into the cold water. He sank for a second, then bobbed to the surface, buoyed by his personal flotation device. He spit out a mouthful of water and spun around. To his relief, the fin was moving away from him. The pod of whales was between Austin and a nearby island. Rather than head in that direction, he began to swim farther out into the bay. After a few strokes, he stopped swimming and rolled onto his back. The chill that danced along his spine was not caused by the cold water alone. A phalanx of fins was chasing after him. He kicked his water shoes off and slipped out of his cumbersome flotation vest. He knew that the gesture was a futile one. Even without his vest, he would have needed an outboard motor strapped to his back to outrun an orca. Killer whales can swim at speeds up to 30 miles per hour. Austin had faced many human adversaries with an icy coolness, but this was different. He was driven by the primeval horror his Stone Age ancestors must have experienced, the fear of being eaten. As the whales neared, he could hear the soft, watery sound they made as air was expelled through their blowholes. Soof, soof. Just as he expected sharp teeth to sink into his flesh, the chorus of steamy exhalations was drowned out by the roar of powerful engines. Through water-blurred eyes, he saw sun reflecting off a boat's hull. Hands reached down to grab his arms. His knees banged painfully against the hard plastic side of the boat, and he flopped onto the deck like a landed fish. A man was bending over him. "Are you okay?" Austin gulped in a lungful of air and thanked the unknown Samaritan for his help. "What's going on?" the man said. "A whale attacked me." "That's impossible," the man said. "They're like big, friendly dogs." "Tell that to the whales." Austin scrambled to his feet. He was on a well-appointed powerboat around 30 feet long. The man who had pulled him from the water had a shaved, bald head with a spider tattoo on the scalp. His eyes were hidden behind sunglasses with reflective blue lenses, and he wore black jeans and a black leather jacket. Set into the deck behind the man was a strange, cone-shaped metal framework about 6 feet high. Thick electrical cables sprouted from the framework like vines. Austin stared at the weird construction for a second, but he was more interested in what was happening out on the water. The pod of orcas that had chased him like a pack of hungry sea wolves was swinging away from the boat and was now headed toward the other kayakers. A few people had seen Austin go over, but they had not been close enough to witness the attack. With Austin gone, the racers were in a state of confusion. Some continued to paddle slowly. Most had simply stopped dead in the water, where they sat like rubber ducks in a bathtub. The orcas were closing in fast on the bewildered racers. Even more frightening, other pods of whales had appeared around the kayak flotilla and were gathering around for the kill. The racers were unaware of the sharp-toothed danger headed their way. Many of them had paddled the sound and knew that the orcas were harmless. Austin grabbed the boat's steering wheel. "Hope you don't mind," he said as he punched up the throttle. The man's reply was lost in the roar of twin outboard motors. The boat quickly got up on plane. Austin pointed the bow at the narrowing gap between the kayakers and the moving fins. He hoped that the noise of the engines and hull would disrupt the orcas. His heart sank when the whales split into two groups and went around him, still intent on their targets. He knew orcas communicated with each other to coordinate their attacks. Within seconds, the pod hit the kayak fleet like a spread of torpedoes. They rammed the light boats with their huge bodies. Several kayaks went over and their passengers were thrown into the water. Austin slowed the boat's speed and steered between the bobbing heads of children and their parents and the knife-like orca fins. The white lightning had moved closer to some capsized kayaks, but the situation was too chaotic for it to be of any help. Austin saw one of the tallest fins bearing down on a man who was floating in the water holding his young daughter in his arms. Austin would have to run over the other kayakers to get to them. He turned to the boat's owner. "Do you have a rifle spear gun on board?" The bald man was fiddling frantically with an instrument box that was connected to the framework by a cable. He looked up from what he was doing and shook his head. "It's okay," he said. "Look!" He pointed toward the mass of overturned kayaks. The big fin had stopped moving. It remained stationary, playfully wobbling in place, only feet from the man and his daughter. Then it began to move away from the broken kayaks and their hapless paddlers. The other fins followed. The surrounding pods that had been closing in broke off their attack and meandered back into the open waters. The big bull breached in a high, playful leap. Within minutes, none of the orcas was in sight. A young boy had become separated from his parent. His flotation vest must have been donned improperly because his head was slipping below the surface. Austin climbed up on the gunwale and launched his body into the air. He hit the water in a shallow racing dive and stroked his way to the boy. He reached him just before he went under. Austin treaded water, holding the youngster's head above the surface. He only had to wait a few moments. The white lightning had launched its inflatable life rafts, and racers were being plucked from the water. Austin handed the boy up to his rescuers and pivoted in the water. The bald man and his boat had disappeared. Kurt Austin Sr. was an older mirror image of his son. His broad shoulders had a slight sag, but they still looked fully capable of battering their way through a wall. His thick, platinum-silver hair was worn shorter than that of his son, who tended to be away from barbers for long periods of time. Although he was in his mid-70s, a strict regimen of exercise and diet had kept him trim and fit. He could still put in a workday that would have exhausted men half his age. His face was tanned from sun and sea, and his bronze skin was laced with a fine network of wrinkles. His coral blue-green eyes could blaze with lion-like ferocity, but, like those of his son, they usually looked out at the world with gentle amusement. The two Austins were seated in plush chairs in the White Lightning's luxurious main cabin, nursing oversized shots of Jack Daniels. Kurt had borrowed a tailored sweatsuit from his father. The waters of Puget Sound had been like a bathtub filled with ice cubes, and the liquor trickling down Kurt's throat was replacing the chill in his outer extremities with pleasing warmth. The cabin was furnished in leather and brass and decorated with polo and horse racing prints. Kurt felt as if he were in one of those exclusive English men's clubs where a member could die in his overstuffed chair and not be discovered for days. His hard-driving father was not exactly the English gentleman type, and Kurt guessed that the atmosphere was designed to smooth the rough edges brought on by his hard-scrabble fight to get to the top in a competitive business. The old man replenished their glasses and offered Kurt a Cuban Cohiba Lancero cigar, which he politely refused. Austin lit up and puffed out a purple cloud that enveloped his head. "What the hell went on out there today?" Kurt's mind was still a blur. He reconsidered the cigar offer, and as he went through the manly ritual of lighting up, he ordered his thoughts. He took another sip from his glass and laid out the story. "Crazy," Austin said, summing up his reaction. "Hell, those whales never hurt anyone. You know that. You've sailed the Sound since you were a kid. You ever hear of anything like that happening?" "Nope," Kurt said. "Orcas seem to like being around humans, which has always puzzled me." Austin replied with a loud guffaw. That's no mystery. They're smart, and they know that we're badass predators just like them. The only difference is that they kill mainly for food. Good point, Austin said. He went to pour another shot, which Kurt waved off. He knew better than to try keeping up with his father. You know everyone in Seattle. Ever come across a bald guy with a spider tattoo on his head? Probably in his 30s. Dresses like a Hell's Angel in black leather. The only one who meets that description is Spider-Man Barrett. Didn't know you were into the comics, Pop. Austin's face crinkled in laughter. Barrett's a whiz kid computer geek who made it big out here. Sort of a minor league Bill Gates. Only worth $3 billion, maybe. He's got a big house overlooking the Sound. I feel for him. Do you know him personally? Only by sight. He was a fixture on the local nightclub circuit. Then he dropped out of circulation. What's with the head art? Story I heard is that when he was a kid, he was a big Spider-Man fan. Cut his hair, had his scalp tattooed, and let his hair grow back. As he got older and started to go bald, the tattoo showed, so he shaved his head. Hell, with the kind of money Barrett has, he could decorate his body with the Sunday funnies and nobody would blink an eye. Eccentric or not, he saved me from becoming whale bait. I'd like to thank him and apologize for commandeering his boat. Austin was about to tell his father about the metal structure on Barrett's boat, but a crewman came into the cabin and announced, "Someone from Fish and Wildlife is here." A moment later, a petite, young, dark-haired woman dressed in the green uniform of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service entered the cabin. She was in her mid-20s, although her black-rimmed glasses and serious expression made her look more mature. She identified herself as Sheila Rowland and said she wanted to ask Kurt about his whale encounter. "Sorry to barge in on you," she said in apology. "We've closed off further kayak expeditions in Puget Sound until we can get to the bottom of this incident. Whale watching is a big part of the local economy, so we've put the investigation on the fast track. The vendors are starting to scream about the ban, but we can't take chances." Austin told her to take a seat, and Kurt went through his story for a second time. "That's so strange," she said with a shake of her head. "I've never known orcas to hurt anyone." "What about attacks in marine parks?" Kurt said. "Those are whales that are held in captivity and put under pressure to perform. They get angry at being cooped up and overworked, and sometimes they take out their frustrations on the trainers. There have been a few cases in the wild where an orca has grabbed a surfboard, thinking it's a seal. Once they discover their mistake, they've spit the surfer out." "I guess the whale I encountered didn't like my face," Austin said with dry humor. Roland smiled, thinking that with his bronzed features and intense light blue eyes, Austin was one of the most attractive men she had ever met. "I don't think that's the case. If an orca didn't like your face, you wouldn't have one. I've seen a whale toss around a 500-pound sea lion as if it were a rag doll. I'll see if there is any video coverage of the incident." "That shouldn't be a problem, with all the cameras focused on the race," Kurt said. "Is there anything you could think of that would stir up the whales and make them more aggressive?" She shook her head. "Orcas have extremely fine-tuned sensing systems. If something gets out of whack, they might want to take it out on the nearest object."
"Like the overworked whales in the marine parks?"
"Maybe. I'll talk to some cetologists and see what they have to say." She rose and thanked the two men for their time. After she left, Austin's father went to pour another round, but Kurt put his hand over the glass.
"I know what you're doing, you old fox. You're trying to Shanghai me onto one of your salvage ships."
Kurt Sr. had made no secret of his desire to lure his son from Numa and bring him back into the family business. Kurt's decision to stay with Numa rather than take over the reins of the business had been a sore point between the two men. Through the years, what had been a bitter source of friction became a family joke.
"You're turning into a sissy," Austin said with mock disgust. You've got to admit that Numa hasn't cornered the market on excitement.
I've told you before, Pop. It's not all about excitement.
Yeah, I know. Duty to country and all that. Worst thing is, I can't blame Sandecker anymore for keeping you in Washington now that he's vice president. What are your plans?
I'll stick around a couple more days. I've got to order a new kayak. What about you?
Got a big job raising a sunken fishing boat off Haines, Alaska. Want to come along? I could use you.
Thanks. But I'm sure you can handle the project yourself.
Can't blame me for trying. Okay, then. I'll buy dinner.
Austin was sawing through a manhole-sized slab of beef at his father's favorite steakhouse when he felt his cell phone vibrating. He excused himself and took the call in the lobby. Looking at Austin from the video phone's tiny display screen was a dark-complexioned man with thick black hair combed straight back. Joe Zavala was a member of Austin's special assignments team who had been recruited by Sandecker right out of the New York Maritime College. He was a brilliant marine engineer whose expertise in designing submersibles had found a ready niche at NUMA.
Glad to see you're still in one piece, Zavala said. The orca attack on your kayak race is all over the news. Are you okay?
I'm fine. In fact, you might say I had a whale of a time.
Zavala cracked the tips of his lips in a slight smile.
I lead such a dull life. Who else but Kurt Austin could turn a charity kayak race into a life-and-death struggle with a bunch of loco killer whales?
The last time I looked, you were well along in your goal of dating every eligible woman in Washington. I'd hardly call that dull.
The gregarious Zavala was much in demand by many of the single women around Washington who were attracted by his charm, his soulful dark brown eyes, and Latin good looks.
I'll admit that life can get interesting when I run into an old date when I'm out with a new one, but that's nothing compared to your race. What happened?
I'm having dinner with my father, so I'll have to fill you in when I get back in a couple of days.
Looks like you'll be back in Washington sooner than that. We've been ordered to sail out of Norfolk tomorrow night.
Do you know Joe Adler?
The name sounds familiar. Isn't he a wave guy out at Scripps?
He's one of the foremost ocean wave experts in the world. We're going to help him find the Southern Belle.
I remember reading about the Belle.
She's the big container ship that went down last March.
That's right. Rudy called me. Adler wants you on the project. Apparently he's got some clout because Rudy agreed to his request.
Rudy Gunn was in charge of NUMA's day-to-day operations.
That's odd. I've never even met Adler.
Sure he didn't make a mistake?
There are a dozen guys at NUMA who've worked searches.
Why me?
Rudy said he didn't have a clue.
But Adler has an international reputation, so he went along with his request to help find the ship.
Interesting.
The Belle went down off the mid-Atlantic coast.
How close is the search area to where the Trouts are working? Paul and Gamay Trout, the other members of the special assignments team, were in the midst of an ocean survey.
Close enough so that we can raft up and have a party, Zavala said. I've already packed the tequila.
While you line up a caterer, I'll change my plane reservations and let you know when I'm coming in.
I'll meet you at the airport. We'll have a plane waiting to fly us to Norfolk.
They discussed a few more details and hung up. Kurt pondered the request from Adler, then went back to his table to tell his father he would be leaving in the morning. If Austin was annoyed about his son's change in plans, he didn't show it. He thanked Kurt for coming to Seattle for the kayak race, and they vowed to get together again when they had more time. Kurt caught an early flight out of Seattle the next morning. As the plane took off and headed east, he thought about his father's muted reaction to his change in plans. He wondered if Austin Sr. really wanted him to join the family business. To the old man, it would be admitting that he was on the road to retirement. Both men tended to have strong opinions, and it would be like having two captains on a rowboat. In any case, His father was plain wrong about Kurt's attachment to his NUMA work. It wasn't the excitement that kept him at the huge ocean science agency. Every opportunity for an adrenaline rush meant many long hours of reports, paperwork, and meetings, which he tried to avoid by staying in the field. The siren call that lured him back again and again was the unfathomed mystery of the sea. Mystery is like the strange encounter with the killer whales. He pondered the incident with the orcas. He wondered, too, about the man with the weird tattoo and the purpose of the electrical setup he'd seen on Barrett's boat. After a few minutes, he put his formless thoughts aside, picked up a pad and a ballpoint pen, and began to sketch out specifications for a new kayak.